thank you. So hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. I was just saying that, you're all making a big mistake. There's a really good band playing. But yeah, right? They're really good. I almost stayed there. Anyway, so to divert a little bit from my introduction, what I'll actually try to do today a little bit is talk about Israeli militarization, but also its connection to here, its connection to the UK. For me, a lot of trying to understand the Israeli occupation is also trying to understand Israeli militarization and what does militarization actually look like. And militarization obviously can mean a lot of different things in different places. And I'm sure that you today now in the UK also have the aspects of what does militarization and increased militarization look like in your own communities. And different places have their own experiences of this. Israeli society is probably one of the most highly militarized societies in the world. And it means that nothing about Israeli society is specifically very unique. Our militarization is not very unique. It looks more or less the same in different places in the world. It's just that ours is kind of on a different level. It's just, it's more visible. You can see it more. Part of that is obviously conscription. So Israel has conscription for both men and women at the age of 18. It's 2 years for women and 3 years for men. Part of that is the whole education system leading up to conscription. So things like a basic training week in the 11th grade. So you go out to a military base with your schoolmates and, you know, play soldier for a week. And that's part of school activities. The whole education system is very much geared towards military service. So if here you'll have military recruiters coming in to schools and career days and things of the sort, in Israel there's no need for that. There's soldiers coming in and out of classrooms on a regular basis in high school anyway. There's a program for high school of teachers that in order to incentivize them to do better, they get financial incentives, so they get bonuses for increasing the excellence of their students, an excellence that's measured on the one hand in increasing grades and on the other hand in increasing what's called social responsibility, which includes enlistment rates. So literally, teachers get paid more for having more of their students joining the military. So looking for militarization within the education system in Israel is rather easy. Looking for militarization in public space, and again, this is something that is not only true in Israel, but we see more and more of our public space being militarized. If it's weapons on the streets, so obviously the UK is probably a little bit of an exception to that, but still, if you look at the processes going on in the UK right now, of more and more armed police, of what does that look like, what do weapons on the streets actually mean, then you have that aspect of militarization that in Israel is a whole different other story. We're talking about around 300,000 private security guards that are armed in the country, talking about a population of 8 million, so you can do the math. Soldiers in and out of duty with machine guns, you'll have soldiers going on leave, they take their M16s home, so you'll go to a pub on a Friday night and you'll be sitting next to a nice assault rifle, and we're kind of used to that. So there's militarization of actual physical space, and there's a huge amount of consequences of militarization. But that's all to say that while we can talk for a really long time about all of those different things, actually what I want to try to focus on is what does a militarized economy look like? Because that's really one of the places that is clearest to see the connection to kind of a more of a global picture and yourselves as well. Before I do that, I will just say that there's more room here in the front and there's people standing out there in the back. So if we could just take a sec to kind of move forward, that would be awesome. So a couple of more logistical things while everyone's sitting down. I'll probably speak for about half an hour and then kind of open it up for more of a conversation and questions and stuff like that. But if you do have clarifying questions, and you think that there's a chance I'll hear you if you shout them out, then go ahead. I also have a tendency to speak a little fast. In British terms, that might actually not be very fast. If that is the case, tell me to slow down. I'll try. Yeah. Okay, so going into the fun stuff. When we talk about a militarized economy, I think one of the first things that we need to think about is the spending, right? How much does the country actually spend on arms, and what does that say about the priorities of a country, right? So if you look here, you'll see military spendings per country around the world. Obviously, there's absolutely no competition to the US that spends more than the 10 next countries after it. So hopefully nobody's going to try to compete with that. You can see the UK somewhere down there. That's when we talk about spendings in absolute numbers, okay? It gets interesting when we talk about spendings in percentage of GDP, when you actually look at the size of the economies that we're talking about. And then you get a little bit of a different picture. So you see here that Israel today is between the second and the fourth, depending on the year, biggest spender on arms in percentage of GDP, right? If you take the world average is around 2%, again, you can see the UK down there, I think 2.2%. And that gives you some kind of insight about the priorities of a country, right? The biggest budget in the governmental budget is the Ministry of Defense in Israel. The interesting thing about this money is that this is all public spending, right? We're looking at governmental spending, that's public spending. Part of that money also comes in from the US. We might get to talk a little bit about US military aid to Israel later. But that's part of the picture. The other part, which is what I'll mostly focus on, is the income that comes from a militarized economy, that comes from a big military industry. Now, Israel's military industry really started growing in the mid-70s after the 73 war, and at least the Israeli narrative was a lot about the fact that in the 73 war, the Israeli military was very much dependent on importing arms, and the idea was we need to make sure that doesn't happen again, right? This whole security paradigm, which is very much where Israel comes from, a lot of Israeli policies come from. So the idea is we have to increase our military industry. And how do you increase a military industry? I assume there's not too many people in the room from the industry. Is that more or less true? Well, those who kind of know it know that military industries can't really be successful in just arming their own military. They have to work more on export. The reason for that, I mean, there's a few reasons for that. One of them is that if you don't export, then you have to, and just make enough weapons to what you need, then in a time of war, you won't have enough to what you actually need, right? Because the time of war increases the demand. And the other part of that is that military equipment, military production is a lot about development. And you can't develop with a flat budget. You can't develop with just doing what you need. And so most of the Israeli military industry, as it grew, became about export. At the beginning, it was a lot of export, both to countries that nobody else would export to and countries that were willing to have development plans and joint development plans. One of the more famous and unfortunate examples of that is apartheid South Africa, that had a very strong military connection with Israel. Israel was one of the last countries to export arms to apartheid South Africa, as in never stopped exporting arms to apartheid South Africa until apartheid ended. They also had a joint nuclear program with Israel and South Africa. So that was one of the very big cooperations. And it's important to say that these cooperations are never just economic. They're never just about the production. And it's interesting to see what governments cooperate with which governments. And there were a lot of ideological alignments between those two governments. I won't go really into that, but it's an interesting topic. But if we fast forward to today, we're talking about a huge military industry that is one of the six biggest exporters of arms in the world in absolute numbers. So if you calculate that per GDP or per capita, you will have the number one exporter of arms in the world. Now, how many of you have been to Israel-Palestine? Wow. I was not expecting that. It's a pretty small place. And it's not a very industrial country. I mean, you're not going to see huge factories. You don't have heavy industry. So it's kind of interesting to ask, how does that happen? How can Israel be the number one exporter of arms? Or honestly, if we look specifically on things like drones, Israel is, depending on the year, combating China and the US in being the number one exporter of drones in the world in absolute numbers. Okay? So if you take the size of the economy, remember the size of the country, that doesn't make any sense. That's crazy. So we kind of have to ask ourselves the question, why or how? How is that possible? Any thoughts about how is Israel's military industry so successful in export? What? Okay, spends more on research and development. Anyone else? Tried and tested. Any other thoughts? You have to shout louder. Okay, it has a diaspora to speak up for it. What do you mean by that? Right, so a very open market. There's a lot of different reasons, obviously, but all four of the ones that I heard here and many others are definitely part of the picture. So as was said, a lot of it is about developing weapons. Now, development of weapons has to do with the amount of funding that you put into it, and a lot of that funding will come from different places. If to mention the U.S. military aid to Israel, U.S. military aid to Israel today is at $3.8 billion a year. They just signed a new agreement for the next 10 years. Does anyone know what the exception, the clause, the catch in U.S. military aid worldwide is? Right, you have to spend the money in the U.S. So that's the main catch generally in U.S. military aid. In Israel's case, there was 25% that did not have to be spent in the U.S. The historical reason for this was a joint development project of the U.S. and Israel to develop a plane called Kfir. For that, the U.S. was willing to put the money in. So it's not always that Israel actually has the money to put into development, but it has the right connections to work at that. But honestly, if you really look at the numbers, the main reason for Israel's arms export is really what was said here before about the ability to test, develop weapons in actual combat. So if we look at combat fields today, if we look generally at the world of the military industry and what sells, I don't know if you've noticed, but wars don't really happen in the good old-fashioned tanks against tanks way anymore. That just doesn't exist. What happens today is what's called counterinsurgency, urban warfare, the whole field of homeland security. That's what exists, which means that's what sells. If we look at the military industry today, that is the field that sells the most. Now, that is the field that Israel has worked for the last few decades on becoming the world leader on, right? So there's a few decades of oppressing and occupied peoples. And so the kind of warfare that you learn while doing that is a warfare that's much closer to policing than soldiering, which is about control of civilian population, it's about counterinsurgency, it's about urban warfare, it's about all those things that sell today. So if you look at the Israeli military economy, the jump that it made in the last decade or two, when really that kind of language of homeland security and everything really jumped, is amazing. And that's because everyone kind of has this idea that Israel does this thing and is really good at it. Which means that if you try to develop a new tactic, then you'll have your soldiers walk in a specific way or do something specific, and then you can say this was done in the streets of Gaza in the last military operation on Gaza in 2014. Or with drones. Israel, as I said before, is a huge drone exporter. If you go to international arms fairs, that there's actually one just next week, beginning of September, there's a huge one in London, DESI, and it's, if you go to any of these arms fairs, you'll have, you know, the different companies have different booths with whatever they're selling. You go to the Israeli company, and instead of showing you some nice 3D illustration of what this thing can do, they'll just show you a video from the last attack on Gaza of what this drone can do. I mean, there's actual evidence of it, right? So, totally skip that one. It's not really interesting. So if you look to the right, that's a poster for the Hermes 450. It's a drone of Elbit Systems, an Israeli company, and you can't really see unless you have really good eyesight. But there's a stamp on the top right side that says battle proven. right? That's how Israel can really sell arms. It's about development, it's about testing, but it's also about the ability to say this is battle proven. It's about marketing, right? So if we go back to development and testing, I can tell you quite a few times you'd go to protests in the West Bank and they'd come with this new toy that God only knows what it does. We'd have these huge machines that would make this really terrible noise. It's called a siren. And the protest continues. It's like, it's awkward. It's not fun. But the protest continues. And after a while, you just don't see them again. And you're kind of like, oh, that's what a failed experiment looks like. You go to another protest, and they come with this thing called skunk water. I don't know if any of you have had the pleasure of meeting the skunk. It's a water cannon. Instead of water, it has this really stinky liquid that is chemically engineered to stick to you and just really stink for a really long time, which doesn't sound very threatening, but I'm talking about, like, you can't sit on a bus for the next 3-4 days, right? Because you literally stink. Nobody can be next to you. So it's a pretty efficient crowd dispersal mechanism, and really all of us would rather get arrested, beat up, shot, whatever, just don't let us touch the skunk. And that works. Right? And then you'll see it sold to the Turkish police, to Baltimore police, to whoever needs that kind of equipment. So you have a really good testing field. And for the record, not just for Israeli companies. This is not just about Israeli inventions, right? Tear gas that Israel uses, most of it is from the US, a little bit of it is from the UK. Good thing about these things for the companies selling them is not only obviously making a profit from selling it, but also that they get feedback. They get to say, this works better than this one, try this brand, this is really effective. And it goes back and you can develop it further so that it's not just Israeli companies in that. So you have that testing and development level, you have then the marketing level, the ability to say this was actually used in battle. And then the last level that's really important is the labeling of it. There's this understanding, and I honestly have no idea what it means, but it's not relevant. There's an understanding that the Israeli military is one of the best militaries in the world. I don't know how you measure these kind of things, but there's a consensus around that. What that means is that the choice of the Israeli military to use a specific weapon makes it a good weapon as far as value market goes, right? So we have all these different levels of why this industry is so successful, which means that really anywhere you go today around the world, you will see Israeli technology. On the left there, you can see the wall being built between Mexico and the US. It is already built. I know we're all kind of hearing Trump talking about a wall. There is a wall. It has been for a while. Most of it is an electronic wall. Most of it is about surveillance. It's Elbit system towers that are put up on that border, which is the same company that did the technology for the wall back home. Right? So that's being exported. If you look to the right, you'll see Israeli armored vehicles patrolling the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. Again, the police of Rio de Janeiro, which is, for the record, the most deadly police in the world, trains with Israeli military, right? When they train with Israeli military, they're training on counterinsurgency. Now, we're talking about a police force. Right? Police forces are not supposed to think in terms of counterinsurgency. And yet, that's how they're trained. That's what it's exporting. Someone mentioned before here the question of really having no morals about who you sell arms to. That's definitely part of Israeli export as well. Today, Israel has very few regulations in arm exports. And when I say very few regulations, just to clarify what that means, we have about 6,800 companies that are registered and allowed to export arms. Out of them, 300 are public. Public knowledge. There was a Supreme Court case to try and get that information, and it was denied. Israel officially only admits to sell to 5 countries in the world, which is slightly ridiculous. The UN registry, there's a UN registry for conventional arms. Israel doesn't report to it, so we can't know officially from Israel who they actually sell arms to. We do know from other countries, like the UK, that do report to the registry who they import arms from. So it's actually pretty easy to know in a lot of these things. But as far as Israel is concerned, there's no transparency on that. There's today 400,000 permits for sales of arms, of weapons and technology from Israel. So there's the 6,800 companies, but they have 400,000 permits for actual transactions. There's 2 inspectors in the country. for the record, not just to inspect the permitted ones, but also all of the illegal export of arms, right? So you can imagine how efficient this system is. It's not completely true. There used to be two. They just opened a slot for national service, which is kind of a volunteer program and a gap year. So they're going to have an addition of an 18-year-old. It's going to help them out on that as well. That's one part of it. The other part of it is a legal framework. And the legal framework today has no human rights regulations on exporting of arms. So most countries have these things. The UK have them in place, not saying that they always actually respect them or don't find ways to kind of go around them. That's what most countries do. But Israel doesn't even have the framework, right? The Ministry of Defense gets to choose who gets to export arms and who does not. There's a little caveat to that, which is that a few years ago, Israel sold some technology to China that the US was not happy about China having. And that was kind of a, you know, awkward moment. And so because of pressure from the US, there's now a representative of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sitting in the Ministry of Defense Committee just to kind of say, the Americans won't like that. It's kind of that person's job. But other than that, it's a completely just a decision of the Ministry of Defense. So a lot of our work is about trying to at least have some caveats regarding human rights in the legal framework that won't allow Israel to sell to wherever it wants to. But as it now can, it means that more or less any country you look at the world, you will see Israeli arms. And that means that in South Sudan, as an example, not only Israeli arms, but also Israeli surveillance equipment that are used to capture dissidents that are later tortured and many times executed. There was just a story a couple of years back. I don't know if you know this, but Israel loves to like talk about how LGBTQ friendly it is. So it's always a little bit ironic when a few years back there was an expose about the fact that an Israeli company was selling spyware to the Ugandan government to spy, find, and then imprison LGBTQ activists. I don't know if you've all been following, but just, 2 months ago, it was revealed that an Israeli, again, spyware company, a software called Pegasus, was used first was used against journalists in Mexico, including threatening their families through it and so on. And just now recently, it turned out that it was also used against the International Commission that was looking into the disappearance of the Ayotzinapa students in Mexico. So really, anywhere you go in the world, you'll find Israeli systems. And usually it's not a very positive representation of Israel or what it does. Possibly an accurate one, but not a very positive one. But if we bring it back home to you guys, the UK is obviously part of this system just as well as anyone else is. Right now there's a contract of about $1 billion that has to do with two companies. One of them is Elbit Systems that was mentioned before, an Israeli company. The other one is Thales, a UK-based company that is working on a drone called the Watchkeeper. The Watchkeeper, which from a military perspective might actually be quite a failure, at least the beginning was, they're working on it. But anyway, it's a drone, it's a surveillance drone. And it's based on the Hermes 450, the drone that I was talking about before. A drone that, again, was sold on the fact that it is battle-proven. And again, this is the same kind of technology that the UK will come, will develop, will change a bit, but in the end, use it as well. So a lot of this kind of global system is really based on Israeli experience and the ability to keep experimenting all the time. But I think the really interesting thing is not just selling arms themselves, but what is the ideology that comes with arms? So if you just don't look at that for a second, I shouldn't have switched. If you, for instance, sell tear gas, you're not just selling tear gas, right? You're not just selling an equipment. You're selling an ideology. You're selling the idea that crowds should be dispersed. Like when you sell crowd dispersal equipment, that is the idea, the ideology that you're selling. It's even more clear when you look at training. So this is a quote from the Israeli police spokesperson. just after the attack in London earlier this year, that was talking, this is when there was a London police came to train with Israeli police, right? This is the context. And he was talking about this attack and said that 8 minutes would be too long. We cannot afford 8 minutes. What he meant by that, 8 minutes was the amount of time that it took to shoot down the attacker in that case. Now, this would not happen in Israel, and everyone knows that this would not happen in Israel. Israeli police prides itself on the fact that it would not happen, because the proximity of guns at any given moment is such that these things end within a minute, okay? Because there's either an armed policeman or a civilian or someone who's going to shoot, right? Now, the Israeli policeman saying that, spokesperson of the police department saying that, what he's saying is in the context of training, what we're saying is this is what we're training. We're training people in the fact that it can't take 8 minutes, and the way that it does not take 8 minutes, and he's very explicit about that, is making sure that everyone's armed. This whole idea that you have about unarmed police, what is that about? Right? So actually looking at the fact that murder rates here with guns are actually really low, and you know, all those kind of things that might actually mean security in your context, in your head, you're all wrong, because security is just about that. Security is just about and kind of focused around the concept of terrorism today, right? And how do we defeat that? And how do we make sure that the response time is less than 8 minutes? And the answer to that is more arms, is more guns. And obviously that feeds into a military industry that's very happy to have that. But more than that, feeds into an ideology and a political system that's very much geared around that. Not to be too depressing, there's something really nice about the fact that I mean, on the one hand, you have this analysis of a crazy, huge military global economy that is working and that we're all kind of stuck in this place. The plus side of this is that it means that in many ways we can really connect a lot of our struggles and we can affect things from our own locations that affect other places in the world. So going back to things that we were working, a lot of our work campaigning against Israeli arms sales to South Sudan eventually led to the fact that Israel, at least officially, stopped selling arms to South Sudan. And that's rather a significant difference also on the ground. It actually means less spyware that is that the government can use, right? So the other side of that is also activists here in the UK trying to do the same with Israel. Obviously, the biggest campaign now, I think, around arms here in the UK is actually around Saudi Arabia. I won't speak to that because I don't know enough about it, but check it out, and it's really important work. But also around Israel during the attack on Gaza in 2014, and then once since then, British activists shut down Elbit Systems manufacturing here in the UK. And I think for me, these are really interesting opportunities because they're not just about solidarity with some other place in the world, which is always important, but making the connection on how this affects you, making the connection between Elbit Systems and bombings of Gaza and the Watchkeeper, and what the Watchkeeper is going to do when it surveils London, right? For me, that's where really the opportunities for us to talk about these things open. And we actually have a lot of power around these things. Most of these companies are publicly traded. Publicly traded means that your pensions are invested in them, which on the one hand means that you make a profit out of it. So we're all kind of guilty here. On the other hand, it means that we can affect this. We can divest from these things. We can look at these things. I don't know if you know, but there's a bill now going through your parliament that will make it illegal to boycott or divest from companies because of their involvement in specific countries. It's aimed against BDS, but in effect, which is a specifically movement around Palestinian rights, but in fact, it'll apply to everything, right? It's an attempt to make governmental institutions, including city councils, including some universities, not be able to divest from companies because of ideology, right? Which really takes a lot of the power away from you, but more than that says, they know that you have that power. They know that right now, campaigns of divestments, of boycotts are working and are actually changing a lot of the realities and the power dynamics on the ground. I want to stop there and see where you all want to take the conversation. So questions and thoughts would be really welcome, because I can talk forever.
Shabbat Shalom. What's the meta-narrative that Israel has behind this? I mean, obviously security, but how does it justify to itself what it's doing and not having, as you say, not having any sort of human rights qualms about who it's selling to? What's the story it tells itself that allows it to do that?
That's a good question, and would be a longer answer, and it would not even get close to answering it. But in very general terms, I think in order to understand Israeli narrative, you really need to understand the level of fear that Israelis live in and are constructed into. My favorite example of this is a month between April and May in the Hebrew calendar, which starts with Passover, so the exodus from Egypt and all that story. The main commandment of Passover, anyone know what it is? Any Jews in the room? What? Right, so the answer there was remember that you were also a slave in Egypt. The actual commandment is just remember. And the question of what do you remember out of that, it varies. And so you'll have more progressive crowds where it'll be, yes, remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Less progressive crowds and kind of the general Zionist narrative is about remembering that there's a song that we sing that translates into, in every generation someone tries to exterminate us and then God saves us from them. Right? This is what you remember. You tell the story from generation to generation. A week after Passover ends is the Holocaust Memorial Day. A week after that is the Soldiers Memorial Day. And the following morning is Independence Day. Right? That's the narrative. Everyone has always tried to kill us, generation after generation. The Holocaust is obviously the worst example of what that can possibly look like. And it's still happening. And soldiers are still fighting and dying, but we have a stake, but we have an answer. So if you like, that is the rationalization. The rationalization is we have to do this. We have to what's called live on our sword. That's the Israeli term. Because otherwise we won't survive just because thousands of years this is what's happening. And then yes, selling arms to South Sudan, that might be a little bit too much. Can't totally justify that by security, which is, by the way, why these campaigns work. But it's also in a context of, but we need a strong military industry because we opened it up in the 73 after the war. Like, we started this because we needed to protect ourselves. This is just collateral damage.
That was a very interesting answer. But the issue for me is that after 70 years of pursuing that policy, Israel doesn't feel any safer than it did 70 years ago and is subject to all the same external pressures, both political and of insurgents, that it's always been under. Why don't they wake up and smell the coffee?
I mean, on the one hand, it's a good question. On the other hand, I think it's a global question, right? It's not that the UK's understanding of there are terror attacks in the UK is, okay, why is this happening? Let's talk about UK foreign policy for a second. No, the answer is, let's go get trainings from Israel. And I mean, that's the world that we live in. It's very true that Israel's experience, it's not just that living on our sword didn't work. It's more than that. The only two countries that have ever been an existential threat to Israel, literally since the day peace accords were signed with both those countries, Jordan and Egypt, that's it. There were absolutely no incidents. Like, the idea of sustainable security through peace has been Israel's actual living experience in the few times they've tried it. And yet that's not the narrative, because the question is not, it's not about 70 years of trying this. It's about 3,000 years of trying this. It's about it being an existential thing that happens in every generation. It's almost not, on some level, I think in many ways it actually takes away agency from Palestinians. It's not even about who's attacking us today. It's irrelevant. It's always going to be like that. And so you're not looking for sustainable solutions. There's this beautiful quote that was taken from a book. I work for a Quaker organization, and they did this delegation in 1970, and they interviewed different Israeli officials, and one of the high-ranking Israeli officials said this beautiful thing. This is 1970, so 3 years before the 73 war. And he said, we have a strong enough military to defeat any combination of Arab armies for the next 5 to 10 years, and who can plan their lives for more than 5 to 10 years? And in many ways, I mean, beyond the irony of 3 years later fighting a war you almost lost, it was just like, yes, that is Israeli mentality. Nobody's thinking about solutions. We're thinking about how do we survive. There's someone here.
As you describe that that cultural narrative and that mentality that's so embedded in religion, ancestral memory, the current goings on, I'm wondering if you see any alternative narrative emerging from Jewish Israelis today that to counteract that.
So next question? No. I mean, honestly, right now, the political space within Israel is rather depressing, to say the least. The general public is going more and more to the right, definitely going away from creating alternative narratives of the sort. That said, yes, they exist. And there's a movement, is small, but there is a movement that is working on what's called joint resistance, on working with Palestinians to resist the occupation, and within that, building a narrative that is about, among other things, being a Middle Eastern country. And we kind of forget that this, you know, there's this colonial concept of a European country coming into what our former Prime Minister Ehud Barak called a villa in the jungle, right? This idea, very colonial idea. So part of that alternative narrative is saying we actually need to be part of the Middle East. We should stop talking about how do we create peace between Israel and other Middle Eastern countries and start talking about how do we actually become a Middle Eastern country, because that's where we are. Majority of Israeli citizens are not white. They're not European descendants. So between Palestinians and between Jews from Arab countries, actually that is the majority. And if we can change a little bit the narrative and talk about that from that perspective, so there are interesting beginnings of other ideas of how you change part of that narrative. But the truth is that the most of society, that's not the direction it's going to. And because of that, I think it's important to say we should not be expecting the actual political situation to change from Israeli narrative change. That's usually not how these things happen, right? It's not the oppressing group that says, actually, you're right. We're changing our minds. That's just not how it is. It's about changing the power dynamic, changing the power structure to allow Palestinians more power within negotiations. And after there will be some form of political solution, it'll be easier to have those conversations, like it's easier to have them today about Egypt and Jordan. I'm just going to notice a slight gender thing. So if women have questions, that would be awesome.
Thank you. In several points in your talk, you said we. I was just interested at who we are. And you also mentioned you work for a Quaker organization. Could you tell us who that is? Thank you.
So I work for the American Friends Service Committee. American Friends Service Committee. It's the biggest US-based Quaker organization. And when I say we, unfortunately, I actually say we quite a lot when I talk about selling arms to other countries, don't I? So many times that's just Israel. But in this context, one of the campaigns that I'm very involved in is a campaign called Hamushim. I will spell that out because there's no way you'll be able to. It's Hamushim, which means armed. It's a Hebrew word for armed. And it's a campaign that's about really looking at Israeli arms industry. Where does it sell in different places? So a lot of the work that I've been talking about is really based on that campaign.
I'd be really interested to know your journey from being brought up in the narrative that you've talked about to the position that you're in now, because on a recent trip with Amos, it just occurred to me that people are just locked in the story that they grow up in, and they're not necessarily bad people. They've just grown up hearing a particular story and they don't have an opportunity to hear a different story.
Different people have different stories, but what I've kind of seen with most of the people around me, and this is also true for me, is that a lot of the turning point is about actually being in a Palestinian village and having a different experience than what you expect. Because you expect this, like, you're supposed to be afraid in a Palestinian village. You walk into a Palestinian village and you literally cringe as an Israeli, right? And the first time I was in a Palestinian village, I was 12, 13, and I went to a nice quiet day of kind of planting olives and so on. And for me, talking to kids my age about their reality was a lot about kind of starting a process, because their reality was, at the time, they were just building the wall. The wall didn't exist yet. And this village, it's a very small village, 22 houses, and the wall was going to separate that village from the neighboring village, which is where the school is. And then this village has their own private checkpoint that only they can go in and out of. And there's a list of names in the checkpoint of everyone in the village. And so talking to kids my age, the things that really bugged them was things like, we can't invite friends over from school, you know, because they're not on the list, they can't come through. And kind of understanding the completely different reality, that on the one hand, you're told this war is about security, this war is about, you know, protecting you from suicide bombings. And I remember suicide bombings, like that was part of our reality. But then going there and being like, actually, this war means that this one Palestinian kid can't visit his friend. Like, how is that about security? Why can't you just move the wall? Why did, like, there's so many other solutions. And when you start asking these questions, it kind of all falls apart slowly. And your whole concept of how this has to do with security and how little it actually has to do with security really crumbles. You have to do all this walking around. Thank you.
Just following on from that, be interested to hear about your experience of resisting and refusing to go in to do national service and ending up in prison.
Oh, that. I mean, I know I don't look very old, but in the refusal movement, I'm like super old. They're all like 18, 19-year-olds. So we actually have two girls in prison right now for refusing to serve. And one of them is just in for her first term, and the second one is just in for her second term. Mainly what happens when you refuse to serve, you can't refuse to serve in the military in Israel. There's no legal way of doing that, which means that your draft date just expires at some point, and you are officially a soldier. And it doesn't matter what you did. You didn't show up. You weren't in the country. Nothing matters. You just legally become a soldier at a specific date. And so that's what happened to me. I became a soldier. But what we usually do as refusers is that we... I mean, there's a lot of ways out of service. You can get out mental health, which is the most common way. You can try to be recognized as a conscientious objector, which is ridiculously difficult but possible. Or you can just go to the military and say, I'm not going to serve because I'm against the occupation or because I'm against any other policy. In which case, the military will be like, okay, we really don't care. You're a soldier. And so what you are is a soldier refusing an order. The order to get in line, take your uniform, start duty. And so you go to prison for usually between a week and a month for refusing an order, and then get a note saying, go back to your military base, continue your service. And you play that game for a while, back and forth, until eventually they get fed up of you and get release you on either mental health or incompatibility. I should say, after 2 months in prison and 3 months in detention, I was released on mental health, so I am officially crazy. It's kind of a disclaimer I should start with. But yeah, that's usually the process. Military prison itself, I mean, it's not fun, but it's definitely not the worst thing you can go through, and especially if you think in comparison to the military prisons that Palestinians are held into, which is a completely different system, it really does not compare. And also the periods of time that we get, which is usually just a few months, it's different ball game. Are you good with time? Because I have no idea what time. Awesome.
There's been some talk in Silicon Valley in the States that if the government should ask them to make surveillance equipment, that they should refuse. Has there ever been something similar in Israel in terms of within the military industry refusing or dissidents that way? And do you think there's any hope of that in the future?
Unfortunately, hardly. Okay, so just a few weeks ago, there was an Israeli drone company that went to sell drones in Azerbaijan, and their Azerbaijani counterparts were like, oh, could you test this thing by bombing this Armenian post for us? And they refused. And actually, so the actual operators refused. Their commanders, their commanders were like, you have to do this. This is how we're going to close the sale. And they actually did refuse. Ended up, the commanders tried to do it themselves. Apparently did a terrible job because they're not drone operators. Obviously not the point. That exists, but on a very small level and definitely overseas. we have not seen that kind of refusal of really saying publicly, we are not going to participate in this in the occupied territories from like intelligence and high tech and surveillance stuff, not during service. There are people who refuse service all the time, kind of more boots on the ground people usually. What we did have 3-4 years ago is a group of ex-intelligence soldiers from the Israeli military, from a specific rather elite intelligence unit called A200, that declared they'll refuse reserve service and actually spoke up about a lot of the things that they did while serving in the military and wiretapping. Again, going back to the LGBTQ issue, it was a pretty big deal. They were talking about how they were told to surveil LGBTQ people and then blackmail them to cooperate with Israel, saying that they'll out them otherwise. So that does exist. There were the people who resisted that. But to say that there's, you know, cause a refusal, if this happens, you all should refuse, that's not really, unfortunately, the place that we're at the moment. There was a few down here. Yeah, it's really hard to walk around. Thank you, Anna.
How many other people are like you are there in Israel? Like, how many refusers? Do you know what percentage of the population refuses to do service?
Why do you ask this question? The optimistic answer is that over 50% of the citizens of Israel do not serve in the military, which is pretty amazing, actually. Out of the Jewish population, only 64% serve. So there's actually a huge amount of people who don't serve for a variety of reasons, either ultra-Orthodox Jews who continue to study in yeshivas or religious women or whatever. People who refuse publicly, say, this is what I'm doing, go to prison. We're talking about, I don't know, half a dozen a year. People who sign letters that they're refusing, but then get out on mental health and so on, we're talking about 100, 150 a year. People who actually get out on mental health and we have no idea what the reasons are is a huge number. So we're talking today about 12% who either don't start or don't finish their military service on the grounds of mental health. That is a huge number. And those are people, some of them refusing for political reasons, some of them for somewhere between political and emotional. I can say personally, after the attack in Gaza in 2014, there's a specific brigade called Golani, which was doing most of the actual combat on the ground at the time. Three of them committed suicide within a month after the attack ended. Personally, I helped five people from that brigade to get out of the military on mental health after that. That's not refusing. But yeah, it's a question of how you interpret it. So we don't really have numbers about what does it look like.
Okay.
Right, so it was just a clarification question about the surveillance from the intelligence unit. That was surveillance of Palestinians in mostly the West Bank and a little bit in Gaza and blackmailing them to cooperate.
Do you think the reason, one of the reasons that they were so eager to invade the Gaza Strip was to try out new weapons? And also, what degree of corruption is in the government that also encourages weapon development?
It's hard to tell what the reasons are, I don't think that that's the main reason that goes through their minds. That there's a huge amount of political reasons that people think about when they choose these things, including elections, including a lot of other things. But in that attack on Gaza, there were over a dozen military systems that had their first operational debut. Less than a month after it ended, there was already a drone exhibit near Tel Aviv selling that same equipment. So I don't know if we can give it as a reason, but it's definitely a motive, and it's definitely there. As far as corruption, specifically regarding the military industrial complex, because I don't know if you know, our prime minister at the moment is under 4 or 5 different corruption investigations, but most of them are not related to the military industry. Only one of them is. To call it corruption is I think interesting, because most of it is legal. I would say it's corruption, but it's legal. So the man who just last week got announced to head IAI, Israel Aerial Industries, used to be the chief advisor for Netanyahu on military issues, in which he handled the privatization of IMI, Israeli Military Industries. So he just finished privatizing the biggest military company in the country. Now he's going to run a different one as a civil. It's not corruption per se, it's legal, but connecting those systems are very clear. And most of these people are ex-generals. Generals get their pension at the age of 45 and go to have a second career. And so you have these people who were, you know, very high-ranking generals, possibly went into politics later, like our former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who was chief of staff in the military, then went to be a prime minister, then went to be Minister of Defense. As Minister of Defense decided on the privatization of the biggest military company in the country, this IMI that this other guy later on actually executed, he decided on that. He was about to retire when he did. He ended up not retiring from politics. There was some political change, so he froze the privatization until he actually did retire. Then it was privatized. He's now in the bid to buy it. One of his main supporters in his political campaigns was Friedman, the head of Elbit Systems. They served in the same unit together back when they were 20, all the way through their 20s, and continued to be really good buddies. Like, it's not corruption. That's actually all legal, unfortunately. But it's there. I mean, it's completely the same system, and you can't really separate between the military industry, the military, and the political system. Okay, so there's probably two questions.
Is there a large standing army as well as the conscript, or is the majority of kind of the boots on the ground army sort of the 18 to 22 year olds?
So half the military, more or less, is conscript. So a military of about 300,000 people, and about 150 are conscripts. The breakdown of boots on the ground, there's far higher percentage of conscript soldiers for sure. There's definitely also professional soldiers everywhere. It's important to say the military itself, every time there's a committee that says, how do we become more of an efficient military and blah, 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 it always has the same answer, which is become a professional military. but there's enough political and social reasons not to do that and to keep conscription. Last question, and if it could be a woman, that would be great. Okay, there's going to be two questions because she's looking for the mic there, but we'll do them both. That question was, what are we aiming for? What are we trying to go? But I'll take that one and then I'll try to combine them.
Listening to you speaking, I'm full of admiration for what you do and say. I just wondered what the voice of women for peace is in Israeli culture and how much in that culture women can have a voice.
Oh, that's a great question. So I'm going to start with that because yours is a really good last question. Okay, so where do I start? Being a highly militarized society also means something about gender dynamics. While Israel prides itself on being the only military in the world that conscripts women and all of that, which is not technically true, but whatever, it's also the role of women is not about being equal in the military. There's an idea of what kind of positions they have. They'll have supportive roles. So it has a huge dynamic within the military, but more importantly, a society that really values your military service and in the specifically high-ranking officers, which are 95% women, specifically combat duty, which are over 95% men, 95% men, obviously, in high-ranking generals, and combat as well, means that space of the elite, of the people who are who receive credit, social credit from being in the military, is a space that's reserved for men. There are exceptions to that. If we look at our political system, you'll see people having their entire campaign around what they did in the military. So when we had an election of Netanyahu against this woman called Tzipi Livni, this is the last woman that had a chance of becoming prime minister. A lot of his campaigns, not quite in these words, but almost in these words, were kind of like, she doesn't have the balls for the job. I mean, it was a lot about like the gender of, you know, she can't really deal under pressure. Her response to that was, she for years served in the Mossad. And so she could say, which is our like CIA, whatever, MI5, which means she could say, I do, right? I could prove myself in those same militaristic, very masculine values. But that's the exception. For the most part, women don't prove themselves in masculine values. We don't do as well in masculine terms. And so there's a huge effect on that, which means that when you talk about a solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, when you talk about movements for peace, a lot of the credibility of people in society to say that is if they come from the military. You'll see generals talking about peace or peaceful solutions much easier than non-generals, which means that the role of women in there is like, I mean, yeah, sure, of course they want peace, but we don't really give them credit around that. And it's a huge issue within Israeli society. It's also a huge issue for the feminist community, which I would say is very much divided on that, because a lot of the feminist community is like, we don't need to talk about Israel-Palestine. We don't need to talk about Palestinians. This is, you know, we have our own issues to forward. And other parts of the feminist community are saying, you can't divide the two. You can't be a feminist community without talking about oppression of Palestinian women or Palestinians in general. Like, that's not feminism. And it's a huge internal debate that if you want to talk about later, I'll be happy to. What's my goal? Was that a question? Where are we going? What are we trying to achieve? That's a great question. I mean, I have a lot of ideas in my head of what...
Can you answer in 2 minutes?
Yeah, sure, of course. 30 seconds. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to be said about this. I have my ideas of what kind of solution I would like to see. I think that many times the conversation is between one state and two state, and it's a rather binary discussion. And mainly the idea is two states. If you look at a map today, you're kind of trying to ask, where do you do that? Where in that crazy Swiss cheese that is the West Bank can you actually create a state that will be sustainable when Israel will continue to control 70% of the water of it? It won't have any geographical continuity. It won't have international borders. And you're kind of like, that's not going to be very sustainable. On the other hand, the discussion about one state is usually like, you're a bunch of naive hippies. We're not all going to, you know, hold hands and sing Kumbaya together. That's not happening. And I think that there's a huge amount of space in the middle that could actually be really helpful to use. I mean, there's federal systems happening around the world. You could create cultural autonomies that will allow people to continue to live in a different language and have a different weekend and all of those things while still having one federal law that takes into consideration that it's one piece of land that's really hard to actually divide. And this is something that would give access to everyone to the different holy sites. It would give, the use of resources. There's a lot of space to work there, but I don't think that's the question. Because it's about changing the political will, and that's where we're really stuck right now. When we'll want to find a solution, we'll find one. And it might be two states, and it might be one state, and it might be something completely different. God willing, it'll be no states at all. But right now, where we really like, where we're really stuck is putting Israel in a place where it needs to do that, where it has an interest to actually look for some kind of solution. So for me, that's really where we're going.